50 years ago, we were recovering from World War II and the Holocaust, still entrenched in the Cold War, and the United States had its first Catholic president. The Catholic Church faced change as well. This month marks 50 years since the Second Vatican Council convened at St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, which led to changes in how Catholics worshiped and how the Church responded to the rest of the world. It allowed Catholics to worship in their own language instead of Latin, for example, taking them from spectators of their religion to participants. Vatican II, the Essential Texts, which brings together the key documents of the Council, was produced this year to commemorate this landmark event. Joining us today is Boston Globe columnist James Carroll, who, along with Pope Benedict XVI, wrote the introduction to the book. James Carroll was ordained to the Catholic priesthood in 1969 and served as Catholic chaplain at Boston University from 1969 to 1974 when he left the priesthood to become a writer. Welcome to the show, James Carroll.
Good morning. My privilege to be with you.
I want to ask a question of our listeners. Were you a practicing Catholic 50 years ago? Do you remember that? I'm going to ask our listeners this. Do you remember the changes and how did you respond? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, James Carroll, why was the Second Vatican Council called to convene in the first place?
It's a great question because it was never supposed to happen. The Catholic Church in the previous ecumenical council, which took place in 1870, so-called the First Vatican Council, Vatican I, had effectively resolved the question of how the Church governed itself by declaring the infallibility of the Pope as a kind of formal note of Catholic belief and practice.
Meaning you just had to follow what the Pope said.
Right. Okay. And so the big surprise when Archbishop Cardinal Roncalli was elected to the papacy in 1958 after the death of Pope Pius XII, the big surprise came when not long after his election, he announced that he intended to convene an ecumenical council. For what purpose? Roncalli was not like most prelates of the Catholic Church at that point, and he had his own distinctive vision of what the Church needed. And he understood at a very basic level that the Church was sorely in need of a fundamental reckoning with its both with its tradition and with the present state of its belief and practices. So there was a big shock, actually, in the Catholic world. I remember this.
He even convened a council.
Yes, that he even convened it. Mm-hmm. And he was quite steadfast in it when his advisors told him it would take, much too long, many too complicated factors to convene a council anytime soon. He basically told them to convene it sooner in that case. He was determined to lead the Church in reckoning with basic problems. It wasn't actually the Catholic habit to think of the Church as having basic problems, but John the 23rd knew something. I would argue, and I admit that this is debatable, but I would argue that the most important thing he knew was that the Church had failed in some basic way during the period of World War II and the decade running up to it. Quite specifically, the Church had failed in the challenge posed to belief and to civilization by Adolf Hitler. Roncalli had himself been one of the few Catholic prelates to actively participate in the rescue of Jews. He was a papal diplomat in Istanbul and towards the end of the war in Paris. He participated in providing documentation Jews needed to escape. He saw the failure of the Church up close when he had to reckon as papal legate with the failures of the Church in Vichy, France. There was something basically wrong with the way in which Christianity not only had responded to events of the 20th century, but actually had, in some of its most basic traditions and beliefs, twisted the meaning of the gospel of Jesus, most especially in relationship to the Jewish people.
My guest is James Carroll, scholar, author, columnist for the Boston Globe. He wrote the foreword for Vatican II, The Essential Texts, which bring together the key documents of the Council. The Second Vatican Council, Vatican II, The Essential Texts, was produced to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Second Vatican Council. If you have a question or comment for James Carroll, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. He was, John the 23rd was certainly different going forward, you know, and calling and convening the council in the first place. But how did you said he was different, not like the others. How was he unlike the others?
Well, he was not an aristocrat, for one thing. Most popes had come from the patrician class, Italians mostly, for centuries. But John the 23rd, Roncalli, came from a peasant family. He was not a Vatican insider. He had spent most of his career as a Vatican diplomat outside the inner circles of Rome. He was a man of the people. He was down to earth. He was not pompous. And he had a spirit of freedom that enabled him to trust what would happen, the absolutely uncontrollable event, if he gathered almost all of the world's Catholic bishops in one place and invited them to take up the great questions of Catholic life, everything from the liturgy to the church's relationship to other religions, especially to the Jewish people, to the church's attitudes toward war and peace, to the way in which the church understood itself in relationship to the Godhead itself. So there was nothing off limits to the first gathering, to this gathering of bishops, at least in the beginning. And the first thing they took up was the basic, one might almost say trivial, but in a deeper way, profoundly significant question of what language to use when worshiping. And the ancient tradition of the church had been that Latin was the perfect symbol of timeless unchangeability of the faith. And so many people assumed that the church would never stop its worship in Latin. Therefore, the Catholic people would never have an intimate experience of their own worship, and they would always be subservient to the clerical class of church leaders who controlled the language, therefore controlled the worship of the church. The first thing the council did was, against all predictions, change the language of the Mass. Against the conservative faction in the hierarchy that wanted no such change, the vast majority of bishops voted promptly to change the language in which Catholics hear the word of God. And at that point, the Pope said, "Now begins my council." The council met in multiple sessions over 3 years, and in those sessions, very, very basic changes were made against all expectations and predictions.
Getting back to the language issue, there have been changes very recently in terms of how the Mass is conducted, the language of the Mass. Was it back with the Vatican II? Was the idea of not just making it in, changing the language to wherever you were, but into the vernacular as well, right?
Well, yes.
Which is a distinction.
Yes, and the genius of the Council Fathers was they understood that the moment was ripe to let the religion come out of the sacristy and into the living room. Let the religion come back where it belonged, into the lives of ordinary people. The Christian faith does not belong to the clergy, and the Christian people are not members of an audience watching the clergy perform something. The clergy do not stand between the Catholic people and God. God is with the people. God is present in and with and among the people. So the most important symbol of that was that the language was not only in the vernacular, but it was ordinary. So, for example, the sacred vessel with which we Catholics remember the moment in the Last Supper where Jesus is sharing wine with his apostles, his friends, For many, many centuries, special language had been used to define, for example, what we called in English, the chalice. Well, in the new translation into English, the priest was not lifting up a chalice, he was lifting up a cup. You made reference just now to recent changes in the language. There's been changes
just about a year ago.
Yes, in the last year. And that's actually a signal of the ambivalence the leadership of the church has shown to the changes of the council. So there's been a slow but steady pushback to some of those changes, and a small symbol of that is that even in English, even while the Mass continues to be said in English in the English-speaking world, although Latin has been reconstituted in many places, even in English, there's a preference on the part of, well, let's call them a conservative hierarchy, for what you might call churchy words, the language of the sacristy. So, lo and behold, Catholics were instructed this year to stop saying cup and start saying chalice again. Seems like a small thing, but look what it suggests. We receive the holy consecrated wine not from an ordinary vessel that we all have at home in our cupboards, but from something that's only on the shelf in the sacristy, that only the clergy control. It's a small symbol, but an important one.
When the Vatican II allowed Mass to be heard in the native language in English, that was really, really obvious. When you start to change words like from cup to chalice, and there are lots of other examples of the changes that came about a year ago, those are more nuanced. And I was wondering, is the reaction been basically the same? Did most Americans at least accept the change to English?
Sure. Most Catholics, understanding the importance of being in communion with the world, with this global institution, most Catholics, even while some understood the negative significance of this change, most of us took it in stride and pay attention, keeping our eye on the ball, pay attention to what matters. So I prefer myself cup to chalice, but I know what a chalice is, and so it's not that big a deal for most Catholics. Most Catholics, in fact, have had a wonderful sense of what matters. And what has mattered most to Catholics, even in this past decade when the Church has been racked by these terrible clergy sex abuse scandals, most Catholics have, even while being appalled and angered by the scandals, have continued to attend the Masses, be participants in parish life, and be respectful of the tradition. It's important not to let the treasure of the Catholic tradition be taken away from us, either by overarching and oppressive authority, or by failures of leadership and behavior on the part of the clergy. Most priests are good men, and almost all Catholics appreciate that, support it, are grateful for it.
My guest is James Carroll, scholar, author, columnist for the Boston Globe. He wrote the foreword to Vatican II, the Essential Texts, which brings together the key documents of the Second Vatican Council. And it was produced to commemorate the 50-year anniversary of that. If you have a question or comment for James Carroll, or if you want to talk about where you were 50 years ago when the changes came about, we'd love to hear from you, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to our Facebook page. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Ira Glass of This American Life, and each week on our program, as you may have heard, we choose a theme. We bring you different stories on that theme. But this week, we are trying something a little different. The theme is things that happened this week. That's right, things that happened in the 7 days leading up to the program, from stories that you might have seen in the news, though we will cover them in a completely different way, to stories so local and personal you will not find them anywhere else this week.
This American Life, Saturday afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. And it's 48 degrees with some rain in downtown Columbus. Expect rain off and on throughout the day, a high of 53. More rain for tonight and a low of 51 degrees. Support for 89.7 comes from COSI, presenting Gunther von Hagen's Body Worlds, The Brain, which explores the beauty and complexity of the human body. This exhibition will only be at COSI for a few more weeks. More at cosi.org/bodyworlds. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is James Carroll. He is a scholar, author, and a columnist for the Boston Globe, and he wrote the foreword for Vatican II, The Essential Texts. Brings together the key documents of the Second Vatican Council, which it was produced to commemorate the 50-year anniversary of that council. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Pope Benedict XVI also wrote a foreword to Vatican II, The Essential Texts. In it, he said that the nature, he actually wrote it, though, a few years back, about 7 years ago. He said that the nature of the council itself was and is misunderstood. What did he mean by that, as far as you know?
Well, I can't speak for His Holiness, but right. It's clear that in the years since the council, there's been a kind of argument within the Catholic community over how far-reaching its changes were intended to go. Some people have said that not much really changed at the council. And that the long tradition of Catholic belief and practice should pretty much go on as it always had. I'm one of those who believes quite the contrary, that very fundamental and important changes took place, the most important of which to me was the Church's absolute rejection of the long-standing tradition of accusing the Jewish people of the murder of Jesus Christ, the slander against the Jewish people that they were the Christ killers, which, of course, was a pillar of anti-Semitism, which eventually was one of the strong sources of lethal Nazi hatred of Jews. And it was the revelation of the depth of that hatred that took place in the middle of the 20th century that's one of the driving elements of what brought about the Council in the first place. So when the Council Fathers, in the document called Nostra Aetate, which is Latin for In Our Time, the first words of the document, when the Council Fathers decreed the end of the Christ killer charge, and furthermore, when they decreed the end of the idea that the Jewish people had been rejected by God, that Jewish religion has been superseded by Christianity, when the Council Fathers made those two declarations about the Church's relationship to the Jewish people, something fundamental to long Christian belief was upended. That's only one example. I would say the most significant example of what the Council did. There are others.
Because the Church before then was above all others in its own eyes.
Well, and it defined itself overwhelmingly against Judaism.
Right, right.
And it wasn't that anti-Judaism was an attitude of bigots or people who were rejected by the Church. No, anti-Judaism and even anti-Semitism, there's a distinction between the two. Anti-Judaism has always been religiously justified. It spawned anti-Semitism. Those attitudes of denigrating Jewish people were the attitudes not of sinners but of saints, the best of the best down through the centuries in the Christian tradition, not just Catholics, Martin Luther famously. This tradition, this was a profound poison in the life of Christianity. It wasn't only lethal for Jewish people, it was an absolute betrayal of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, who, after all, was himself a Jew. How in the world could we denigrate the people to whom Jesus himself belonged? The council reckoned with that quite bravely, quite directly, and even though it set in motion basic theological changes that have yet to be fully completed. For example, if the church is now saying that the covenant God has established with Israel is full and complete and permanent, what does that do to the old Catholic idea that the only way to God is through Jesus?
Right.
Well, another way to God is through the covenant God has made with Israel. Jesus is not necessary to that. That is a theological, that's an unfinished theological question. And listen, there's no surprise that Catholics, especially Catholic leaders, have pushed back against such basic changes because that's how deep they go. So the fact that the church hierarchy has been ambivalent about the council over these last couple of decades, Pope John Paul II and now Pope Benedict XVI are both have both shown profound ambivalence about the changes of the council. No surprise that they should. That's just a signal of how deep these changes go.
It's somewhat ironic the demonization of the Jewish faith as, you know, the faith that killed Jesus. Before Vatican II, Catholic relationship with Jesus wasn't much. It was more Mary.
Well, that's another example of how the council took on some of the ways in which the church needed to adjust itself. You're absolutely right. The piety of Catholics was, Jesus was not in the center of it. In fact, Jesus had become such a remote figure in the Catholic imagination that it was felt that saints, especially St. Mary, had to be kind of mediating figures between the believing Christian and Jesus himself, when, of course, the whole idea of what Jesus is in the Catholic imagination is he is the mediating figure. Jesus is the one who enables us to have a clear access to the Holy One, God. So down through the centuries, for very human reasons, Catholics had downplayed the place of Jesus in Catholic life. Catholics had lost a intimate connection with the New Testament, with the Bible itself.
Right. They had prayer books. They didn't have Bibles.
Yes, we had prayer books and missals. Mm-hmm. We didn't read the Bible. We were not encouraged to read the Bible. The Bible was, it's one of the distinctions between the Catholic tradition and Protestantism. One of the Reformation's revolutions was basically bringing the Bible back into the life of ordinary Christian believers. Catholics were slow to come to that. That's another major change that the council initiated, so that now at Mass every week or every time we go to Mass, we hear the Scripture proclaimed in our own language. We hear sermons addressed to the Scripture texts themselves. We used to get sermons from all over the place, mostly about the saints or about, you know, mm-hmm. I remember Monsignor, when I was a kid, usually preached either about the Blessed Virgin Mary or about our need to support the church with money or about the wickedness of people who were missing Mass on Sunday, which I actually never understood because there we were. Why were we hearing about the people who weren't there? You
preaching
know?
To the
And now Catholic preachers are instructed in seminary and, you know, develop the skill of addressing the Scriptures and constantly measuring Catholic faith against the example and teaching of our Lord Jesus.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking, it's the 50th anniversary. It's been 50 years since the Second Vatican Council convened at St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. Those changes changed many things about how Catholics worshipped and about how the Church responded to the rest of the world. Vatican II, the Essential Texts, brings together the key documents of the Council and was produced to commemorate the event. And I'm talking with James Carroll right now. He's an author and a columnist for the Boston Globe, and he wrote the foreword for the Vatican II, the Essential Texts. If you remember back to Vatican II, if you were a practicing Catholic then and remember the changes and have any recollections about them, Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Irene in Newark, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Irene.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question for Mr. Carroll. Somewhere I read that on papal infallibility, if the teaching is not received by the faithful, it cannot be considered infallible. And I wonder if he could comment on that, and I will take this off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Irene.
Well, Irene, it's a very smart and important question. It goes to this. One of the mysteries of Catholic life is what actually does the teaching on papal infallibility mean? And what you've lifted up there is an example of, what I would call one of the nuances that we have to apply when we try to wrestle with this notion. In a simple way, people have been under the impression that the Pope speaks, as the formula says, on matters of faith and morals, and that settles the question. But what you remind us is it's much more complicated than that, that the long tradition of Catholic understanding includes that the teaching of the hierarchy, including the Pope, is not complete until the faithful have themselves accepted it, have themselves begun to shape their faith in response to it. And implied in your question are great issues, for example, of the Church's teaching today most dramatically on matters of sexuality. Let's take the most obvious example, birth control, a teaching that has been reiterated. Experts do not claim that the teaching on birth control is itself, quote, infallible, unquote, although even that's debatable. Some people believe that it is, which, of course, would itself undercut the idea of infallibility. But no matter how you cut it, the Catholic people have not accepted that teaching. And so where does that leave it, and where does that leave the authority of the hierarchy? The tragedy of the Catholic Church in our lifetimes is that bishops and popes have tried to defend their authority by reiterating this 20th century teaching about contraception, but in doing so, they have effectively undercut their authority.
You're a prominent critic of the Church and its teachings on a raft of issues, from birth control to the male-only priesthood. And you've been critical of the Pope as well, but you're still a practicing Catholic. And sometimes people, they wonder, how does that work? How can you disagree with so much and still be a practicing Catholic? And I'm not talking about you particularly, but about Catholics in general.
Well, one of the other great affirmations of the Second Vatican Council was the supremacy of conscience in the document published in this book, Dignitatis Humanae, on the dignity of the human person. It's quite clearly stated that the dictates of conscience are the supreme guide for the Christian life. Catholics are obliged and quite ready to take fully into account the teaching of the authorities of the Church. But finally, each Catholic has to make his or her choices of conscience in the sacred realm of their own conscience. And that is actually true to the long tradition of the Church. This isn't a modern phenomenon. There's a way in which, going back to the very beginning, the Church has included in itself multiple points of view. The idea that there's only one way to be a Catholic and only one teaching on major questions is a modern idea. It's one of the wonders of the Council that we return to a much more ancient tradition, which is that the Church is a community within which various points of view are heard and respected. There are four Gospels in the New Testament, not just one. That is to say, there are four slants on the meaning of Jesus Christ, not just one. And that's a symbol of the diversity that has been a mark of the Church from the beginning. So the Catholic Church, like every community, has to live with the tension between the cohesion that keeps us together as a beloved group and the necessary independence of thought and conscience that each individual in the group has a sacred obligation to maintain. And I would say the church is doing a pretty good job of that. Yes, I'm a critic of some of the teachings of the hierarchy, absolutely critical of the misogynist rejection of women for the priesthood, absolutely critical of the church's mistaken condemnations of birth control. But I'm a Catholic like millions of other Catholics who hold to these same positions. And the bishops accommodate that. They may not be pleased about it, but they accommodate it. They know that the Catholic Church is more than the bishops. In fact, the church isn't just the hierarchy. The Second Vatican Council makes it very clear that the church is the people of God, and we are all in this together.
I was interested to read in your foreword of the text to the text. You write about the deeper level, and part of that is about the exclusivity ended and so forth. But it also, you said, obliterated the idea that religion and science are enemies.
It's true. The Second Vatican Council was responding to the crisis of modernity, and there has been for a couple of hundred years this terrible fear that it's impossible for religious faith to be rational if you're a believer. That somehow means you sacrificed your intellect, and this leads to this notion, this really deadly notion, that science and religion are oppositions. Science came out of the religious culture of Christianity. Don't forget, Galileo, the argument with Galileo was an argument first within the church. Copernicus, to whom Galileo was responding, was a Catholic priest. There is no fundamental opposition between science and religion. And the old tradition of Christianity is that religion is a way of knowing and a way of thinking, and thinking is a way of paying attention to what's beyond, the mystery of life in the universe. Religion and science go hand in hand, properly understood. The council brought us back to that understanding in some very basic way.
Phil in Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Phil.
Hi, I hope I can state this as clearly as possible. I grew up a Catholic. And in growing up Catholic, my parents, especially my mother, made it appear to me that the Protestants were outcasts. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we never read the Bible. I mean, I never saw anybody look at the Bible in our house. And the sermons were pretty much like you described. But then I left the church, got buried outside the church. I now go to a Presbyterian church. And over the last 20, 30 years, you know, the thing I've been amazed at that is how developed many of them are, how participant they are in the life of the church, and how, you know, many of them read the Bible, can quote it chapter and verse. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, this to me was a total revelation based on the household I grew up in.
Right.
And it seems like the ecumenical step of Vatican II was to try and tear down some of those walls.
Thank you, Phil.
A wonderful observation. Was it Phil?
Yes, Phil.
Yeah, wonderful observation, Phil. What you lift up is the way in which the Second Vatican Council marked the end of the Catholic reaction to the Protestant Reformation. There was effectively a war between Catholicism and the Protestant Reformation, and it went on for several centuries. And you and I, maybe, I'm not sure how old you are, Phil, but I'm of the age that when I was a child, I was told that Protestants were not only the enemy, they were all going to hell. The only way you could go to heaven is by being a Catholic. There's no salvation outside the church. That was a defensive doctrinal response to the threat that we Catholics took from the Protestant Reformation. And it was still lively right into the 1950s. In fact, you could say that the council began when Archbishop Richard Cushing of Boston in 1953 excommunicated a Catholic priest whose name was Leonard Feeney for teaching in sermons on the Boston Common no salvation outside the church, especially Jews are going to hell. And Cushing knew that there was something wrong with that, and he told Feeney to stop it. And when Feeney didn't stop it, Cushing excommunicated him, said he was no longer a Catholic. Feeney appealed to Rome, certain that the Vatican would uphold him against Cushing, because Feeney knew that for 1,000 years that's what the church had taught. Guess what happened? The Vatican upheld Cushing's excommunication of Feeney. And I remember thinking, I was 10 years old. That was the beginning of my theological education. I said to my mother, Mom, they excommunicated a priest for teaching no salvation outside the church. I thought that's what we believed. My mother said, it was. And I said, what do we believe now? She said, we believe live and let live. You know, my mother was anticipating what the council taught us. So a decade later, this becomes the formal teaching of the church. And Cushing, by the way, is right there in the thick of the council making the argument. Mm. And by the way, why did he do it? Why was Cushing the one to start this? Because his sister Dolly was married to a guy named Steve Perlstein, a Jew.
Okay.
And Cushing knew that Steve Perlstein was a good guy and there was no way he was going to hell. And that basic human experience transformed, trumped, you could say, the old theological tradition. That, in a nutshell, is what the Second Vatican Council did. It put experience over mistaken doctrinal tradition. And it changed the tradition.
I'm talking with James Carroll, a scholar, author, columnist for the Boston Globe. We're talking about Vatican II. We'll return after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Hi, this is Fred Anderle. Join me this Sunday for Conversations About Faith. We'll learn more about the experience of faith in God with Christian contemplative Marcia Sinitar. We'll discover what people mean when they say they are spiritual but not religious with theology professor Linda Mercadante. And we'll talk with neurosurgeon Eben Alexander. He says that while in a coma, he had a personal experience of God and heaven. Conversations About Faith, Sunday at 3 on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. All Sides Weekend begins with host Marilyn Smith and a discussion of the best food and restaurants in Central Ohio. That's All Sides Weekend from 11 till noon. Expect rain today, off and on throughout the day, a high of 55. More rain tonight, a low of 51. And rain is likely for Saturday, a high of 53 degrees. More rain on Sunday, maybe a thunderstorm, and a high of 56. Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Foundation, which can help strategically prepare now for the coming changes in charitable tax rates. There is a reason why the Columbus Foundation is the 9th largest community foundation in the world. Its scale and experience works for our community. More online at columbusfoundation.org. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about Vatican II. I'm still with us, James Carroll, scholar, author, columnist for the Boston Globe. He wrote the foreword for the Vatican II, The Essential Texts, which brings together the key documents of the Second Vatican Council from 50 years ago. Joining us now is Leo Madden. He is head of the Department of Theology at Ohio Dominican University. Hi, Leo. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Ann. I'm happy to be here with you. Hello, Mr. Carroll.
Good morning, Leo. It's nice to hear your voice.
I thought we could look forward now or at come up to the present and talk about the changes now. And Leo, the more I learn about Vatican II, the more I realize what you do is sort of a moving target in a way.
Well, yes, indeed.
So there are considered attempts to roll back the changes from Vatican II. Where is it coming from, in your opinion, Leo, and where is it going?
Well, I think what I see coming from Rome and Pope Benedict focuses first of all on the area of liturgy, that is to say on the sacred acts that when Catholics gather for the Mass and for other periods of prayer and sacraments. And there is a concern, and Pope Benedict shares this, that there has been a movement where the Catholic liturgy has become as informal or tends to attract elements of informality that is consistent with the rest of secular society, where nothing is really different from anything else. And Benedict and many other Catholics believe this as well, that what Vatican II wanted to do in regard to the liturgy was to revive the sense of the sacred, to get to the center of what is actually happening in the Mass and with individual prayer life and community prayer life. And the desire to go back to what some would say more traditional forms of prayer and maybe the Latin Mass and is really an expression of a desire to return a sense of sacredness and differentness in that period, in that sacred act.
Do you think that that was intended all along? In other words, Vatican II wasn't intended to make Catholicism more informal. It just evolved that way after it came down.
Well, I'd be interested to hear what Mr. Carroll has to say about that, because I was only a elementary school child when the liturgy changed. We see the repeated phrase in the Vatican II documents that the council encourages the laity to full and active participation. All right. And this is in response to a number of trends over the previous couple of centuries where individuals did not engage in full and active participation. They were saying their beads in the back of the church. They were reading their prayer books. They were allowing liturgy to be something that only the priest and perhaps the altar boys did. Even Benedict in his reflections on his activity at the council says that the main desire was to strip away all sorts of growths that had occurred, right? Not to put too harsh a point on it, but sort of like weeds that had grown up around liturgical expression, so as to get back to the real deep spirit of communication with the Lord. Now, whether what happened in the life of the liturgy, especially in the United States in the late 60s and the early 70s, was, you know, motivated by that, or where there was just a desire to just throw off anything at all engage in, and use the vernacular regardless of any other purpose, I leave that to the internal, you know, readers.
I love some of the notes you're striking, Leo, and I'll attempt to elaborate maybe. But for me, the most important issue is that the traditional distinction between the realm of the sacred and the realm of the profane in Christian life is a false distinction, that our faith is embedded in this magnificent idea, the incarnation captures it, that all of creation is sacred and all of human life is sacred. And the way to be present to God is by being fully present to human life and human experience. And that basic Christian idea has been revivified since the council. And a great symbol of it is that the Mass, which was lost to the people because the sacrificial aspects of the Mass were emphasized to the exclusion of the other thing that the Mass is, which is a meal, a simple meal. The Eucharist, after all, beginning with the simple meal that Jesus had with his friends on the night before he died. And it's true that that meal was understood in early Christianity in line with sacrificial traditions. So we began to celebrate the meal on the altar. An altar is a structure of sacrifice. The Second Vatican Council invited us to think of the meal being celebrated on a table, a very simple idea. But when you look at the architecture of Catholic churches now, since the Vatican Council, Catholic churches are organized not around a high triple-tiered altar up against the far wall, but they're organized around what's effectively a table, somehow moved toward the center of the community, mm-hmm. because this is the meal the community is sharing with the Lord. And the priest is positioned then within the community as the servant of the community, so that the community together is making the Lord present. And the great symbol of that is the movement from the high altar to the table in the middle of the community. And it's true that today some people would like to move that high altar back into prominence in the Catholic liturgy. And I myself think it's a mistake if we go in that direction.
And if I could elaborate on something that Mr. Carroll just said.
Leo Mann.
What Mr. Carroll just spoke about in regard to the two aspects of the Mass, a sacrifice and a meal, exemplifies something that Vatican II recognizes. That is to say that so many aspects of a Catholic life and Catholic teaching and liturgical life is a creative tension of a variety of two or more goods all at the same time. And that we allow, as Mr. Carroll just explained, in the architecture and the very use of space in the Mass, we have a meal on an altar. This is a matter of creative tension that is present. We're not trying to eliminate one or the other. And this happens over and over again. The whole notion in Vatican II of collegiality was not settled and will probably never be settled. There is a creative tension regarding who is the successor of Peter and who are the bishops and the other bishops in the College of and you could go, what is the church hierarchical? Is the church the people of God? The Vatican II document said it is both. So perhaps in a way, I'm not saying that the Catholic Church can be a megaphone in service to the entire world, but in our society where we are where we live with intention, and what we want to do is eliminate the people we don't agree with, the Catholic Church allows for the fact that there is always going to be views that are slightly different because the church or the teachings of the church, the teachings of Christianity, are immense.
This conversation, of course, probably wouldn't be complete if we didn't talk about women in the church. We got touched on it a little bit earlier on, but last April, the Vatican issued a report declaring that the umbrella group representing most American nuns had strayed from church doctrine and adopted, this is in quotations, radical feminist views. Rome ordered Seattle's Archbishop to begin monitoring all operations of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. Is this another example of that pushback now, James Carroll, or is there something deeper to this?
Well, you know, this is so important. The hierarchy's relationship to the question of women in the church right now is sinful. Just imagine if the hierarchy of the church had a policy that said, people of color, people of African descent are not allowed to be priests. We in America and in the world broadly over the last two centuries have moved through a revolution in human understanding and imagination to understand that racism is criminal. 200 years ago, racism was a virtue of European culture because it undergirded the hierarchy of being with white people, white Europeans, at the top of the hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that has been at play down through the centuries about males and females, the patriarchal culture, with the assumption that male supremacy is a basic note of the natural world, has been upended. Mostly by the women-led revolution of feminism. And thank God it has. And patriarchy has been overturned in one institution after another across the globe. And we see now that the place of women and the well-being of women in every community and society is a key factor in that community and society's broad well-being. The Catholic Church is not going to survive its refusal to acknowledge the truth of feminism and the truth of the equality, the full equality between males and females. The recent move against American Catholic nuns is only the latest and not even the most grievous manifestation of this. Let's call it what it is. It's a sin, and the Church will, before too long, be repenting for it, much in the way that John Paul II so nobly led the Church in its repentance for anti-Semitism. Well, the anti-woman attitudes of the Church's hierarchy are akin to racism and anti-Semitism, and they must be changed and they must be repented of.
And if I could just...
Yeah, Leo, we're running out of time, but Leo, please go ahead.
Very quickly, that Rome's investigation into the Leadership Conference of Women Religious is a matter of looking into the practice of a particular bureaucratic structure and the leaders of that bureaucratic structure. It's not an attack upon all nuns. It's an opening of an investigation into, are these leaders of these various organizations carrying out conferences or encouraging various charisms that are consistent with the Catholic faith or not? And so it's not, this investigation is not in itself presaging a criticism of all women in the Catholic Church.
It's in the eye of the beholder, I'd say.
Yeah,
Leo. I actually know plenty of nuns who feel quite roundly attacked, and I don't think they're imagining things, frankly.
Well, as with a lot of issues Catholic, there's differing opinions. And I want to thank you both for sharing yours today. Dr. Leo Madden, head of the Department of Theology at Ohio Dominican University, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thanks, Anne. Thank you, Mr. Carroll.
Thank you, Leo. And I really appreciate the note you struck about tension, creative tensions in the Church. I couldn't agree more.
Yes.
James Carroll, scholar, author, columnist for the Boston Globe. Thanks again for joining us, James Carroll.
Privilege, Anne. Thank you so much. I wish you well.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.